Well, good day to you. It's Joel with The King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
Hey guys, this is Dave Barnes.
And this is John McLaughlin.
And welcome to Dadville. Dadville is a podcast where we talk about life, love, and the pursuit of awesome dadding.
On today's episode, we talk with our good friend David Thomas. David is the director of family counseling at Daystar Counseling here in Nashville, Tennessee, and he has co-authored 8 books, which is 8 more books than you or I have
combined.
Authored or co-authored combined.
This episode was really fun, and I would argue maybe the most informative as far as a child's perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
that's
I really
fascinating.
Like. Really, really interesting. David meets primarily with children at their counseling center. And so it provides a really cool perspective. A lot of the guests that we've had and we'll have on the podcast speak a lot from their experience being a dad or
parent,
adult.
Yeah,
adult, human, child. But David is really able to speak to the child's experience, which is invaluable. So he's very helpful in illuminating sort of things that kids go through and the way they struggle through things. And I think how we can sort of help them, no matter who we are to them, and dealing with those things.
Yeah, this was really fascinating and really helpful,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, so strap up and enjoy your time in Dadville. Dadville. If you're a one, you already have enough inner voice. So
yes.
This is just amplifying what's already
Already going on in all moments. Yes. That is the absolute truth.
You've already got
yes.
The dialogue. This just amplifies.
A screaming loud voices. My baseline.
That's right. Yeah, that's just where you
that's
begin.
Where I wake up.
You said if you're a one?
Oh, yeah.
Is that? So you're
have
a
you
one.
Studied the Enneagram?
Yeah. I'm not a scholar like Dave, but as far as I can tell, I'm a 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
John is like a really chill, healthy 4.
That's
yeah.
Great.
I think. We're still trying to figure out what Amy is. We think she's a 6.
Okay.
But yeah. With a heavy 7 wing.
Yeah, yeah. Like almost tipping over sideways.
Really?
Yeah. And 0-5. There's no 5 happening. Just like I'm a 4 with a 3 wing, and I have no 5 happening.
At least y'all share a no 5.
Yeah, there's
y'all
no 5.
Go this way.
That should be another category. We as a couple are just a no 5. We're a no 5. And a no 1, actually. Amy has taken, you know, several tests, and it's hilarious because, you know, rank it gives you're a little bit of each number, a little bit. She is 0-1.
Really?
She never has any 1.
Bless her.
So whatever's whatever's happening in there is not happening.
Yeah. I would love
you're
to
making
know what
up
that's
for her.
Like.
You don't even know her.
I've got it
you
covered.
You just got her portion.
Yeah.
The Lord just divvied Amy McLaughlin's portion to you.
And what are the two of you?
We're 7 and 8s.
Okay.
So I'm a 7, 8, and 8. It's funny because majority of marriages, not all, but like the majority are wing, you know, they touch. And so ours is, you know, that typical bordering marriage.
Yeah.
You see the friction I'm doing.
Dude.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So, David, I got to tell you, I told John and even telling Amy last night, I'm so excited about this. And I'm excited about this for a lot of reasons. One, because, you know, we just went to you and Sissy's. You're in Sissy's? Sissy and Hughes.
I'm tracking with you.
You're with me.
The class.
The class that you guys put on at our church, which was, I don't know how y'all covered that amount of information in that amount of time, because I think it was like 3 hours, and you guys basically just body slammed what that information between, you know, sort of infant to teenage in both genders, which was amazing. And we have referenced that numerous times.
And so, after that happened, they came over to our house, and I think we stood in the kitchen and talked with Annie for a solid hour.
Yeah.
She was just sort of like debriefing everything that you guys had talked
about.
It's
an overwhelming amount of content. I bet you needed a nap. But, or to get away from us, one of the
well,
other.
It's funny because thankfully I took notes in my phone, which kind of kept me not only engaged, but was like, it sort of, I was having to stay, you know, mm-hmm. instead of sort of like, oh, and then dreaming like, oh, you know, he did that yet. My son did that yesterday. And, you know, kept me sort of in. But, you know, we realized, you know, we've had, as I've told you, we've had some incredible guests on, but no one that is a specialist in kids. Hmm. So it's a really, like, I am so excited about this because it's not just you're a counselor therapist, but you're a counselor therapist who spends so much time with children, which is really, I mean, I think when we thought about doing this podcast initially, something we both, you know, may have been one of the biggest empathy. I loved his first album.
Impeto.
Yeah. But, you know, for having people on is going, yeah, how can we talk about our kids? How can we talk about being dads, which we've done a lot of. But this episode I'm especially excited about because I think it's our first real foray into how kids are. How are they doing? What do we need to be thinking about? So I'm so glad you're here. This is where I do, we call this a brag sheet, so get ready. David Thomas, would you tell us what LMSW means?
I will. Licensed Master Social Worker.
Oh!
Oh, Master.
Wow.
Licensed Master Social Worker.
You know what's funny about that, though? It sounds so impressive, it's not. I have a therapy dog. We use dogs as a part of our practice. And my dog has like four more letters than I do. It's so humbling.
Like,
well, he at least gets K9, so he gets a number too.
He starts off ahead of the game.
There's no room to feel great about my letters when you have a dog who has more. No,
yeah. Master is part of your title.
And licensed. So this is not so something medieval. You just said, I think I'm a master now. Somebody was like, no, we'll notary. We'll put that, we'll like document that. Okay. So David is the director of family counseling at Daystar Counseling in Nashville, Tennessee, the co-author of 8 books, which is.
Eight more than I've written.
That's right. Including the best-selling Wild Things, Art of Nurturing Boys, a frequent guest on national TV or television podcast, been featured in USA Today, A Million Other Things, speaks across the country. His newest book, which is not true anymore. Oh, do you have a newer book than this? This is the newest book.
This is the newest book,
good.
Okay. Yes.
Is Are My Kids on Track? The 12 Emotional, Social, and Spiritual Milestones Your Child Needs to Reach. He recently released a podcast with Sissy and Melissa, who he works with at Daystar. Based on the same book, he and his wife Connie have a daughter, twin sons, double down, and a feisty yellow lab named Owen. You can follow him on social media at Raising Boys and Girls, and catch the latest Technology Tuesdays and parenting resources on its blog at raisingboysandgirls.com. Like I said, I am thrilled that you're doing this. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, I'm honored.
And after you spoke at Covenant, and we went and saw your tutorial, I literally, like Annie was like, just don't overwhelm him because I made such a quick beeline to you. I was like, hey, it's so good to meet. Will you please come do this podcast? We would love to have you on. So one of the things that I kind of want to start with is your intentionality parenting book. What is it? What's the official title?
Intentional parenting.
Yeah, who knew that would be that simple? But I think just starting off, that is a real, I feel like that may be one of my biggest struggles as a dad, is sort of trying to figure out how to be intentional, how to not, my tendency is to just sort of groundhog every now and then and kind of, hey, how's everybody doing? Okay, good. And I disappear back into whatever my escape at the moment is. And can you sort of speak to intentionality as a parent? Like how do you encourage, especially dads, in that what are things that are good to try to do? Is there, I'm sure there's a, you can overdo that as opposed to living in the moment, those kind of things. But, and mostly, can you just tell me everything's going to be okay? That's really, I'm trying to get with this.
Let's start right there. Everything is going to be okay. Okay,
thank you.
Oh, God. Thank John, are you with me? I'm feeling really
gosh.
Don't you feel like half of what we really, maybe
that's really. I think I literally have that written in my notes. We'll get to that later.
I feel like most people we have on this podcast, all we're really wanting is for them to look at us and be like, it's going to be
all right.
I'm feeling good.
Yeah. No, sorry. So, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I will say, first off, it genuinely is a pleasure to do this. Thank you all for inviting me. I love meeting the two of you that day. I was so honored you came and would spend that time. And as we were laughing about a little bit earlier, I mean, it's an overwhelming amount of content. I mentioned that to say, I think that's one of the most intentional practices I think we can be about as parents. Of just, we talk a lot about becoming students of the kids we love and what does it look like to study development, which was really what that whole day was about. And, you know, thinking about these really specific things that are happening in our kids' lives in different moments. And I think back a lot on that. I love that passage in Psalm 139 where it just talks about how we're made in the secret place. And there is all the language around that speaks to an intentional God who made us in a certain space in a certain way. And that process continues, that these really fascinating things are going to be happening in our kids' lives in all these different moments. And I think it's our job to, as dads, as moms, to lean in and understand what that's about. And my belief is that to the degree that we do, we're less alarmed about what's coming. I think we're less overwhelmed when we start to feel and experience shifts. And I always think about one in particular. You know, Sissy and I have been teaching that class together for over a decade. And I have heard her talk more times than I could count about the shift that happens for girls. So tuck this away, gentlemen. You're not knocking on this moment, but it will come. I had heard her talk about the shift that happens with dads for a daughter as she steps into puberty and her body starts to change. And this little girl who would run to the door the second you walked in and just embrace you, nearly knock you down. She was so excited to see you. All of a sudden starts to side hug you and look stiff and uncomfortable. And that has nothing to do, I know, hang in there with me, hang in there.
Feeling physical pain.
I know that has nothing to do with your relationship and everything to do with the evolution happening with her. Yeah. And that two things are going on. One, she's uncomfortable, as every one of us was when we were going through those changes in our body, with what's happening with her body. And the last thing she would want to be doing is pressing up close against another person. Yeah. And the other reality being that for the first time ever, it has occurred to her that you're a boy. Mm. Like, she's never really thought about it in that way. This creature that she feels so awkward and uncomfortable around, you happen to be. And so that explains developmentally so much of what's happening. And I remember hearing her talk about that time and time again, and I would hear it and, you know, file it away. And then I can remember the moment. I can even remember where I was standing in my kitchen when it happened the very first time with my daughter.
Really?
And I remember thinking, I am so grateful that I knew this. And I'm so grateful that I've leaned in to understand what's going on biologically, relationally, on so many levels, that it's not, I haven't fumbled the ball. I mean, I have, but that did not explain why that was happening. Development had everything to do with it. So that's but one of 100 examples I could put to it where I think there's something so important about studying development. I would also say, I think being a student of our kids involves studying temperament. The three of us were laughing about the Enneagram a little bit earlier, and we use that tool a lot at Daystar, and I really believe in that, or some tool that allows you to lean in a little bit farther to understanding the unique hardwiring of each of your kids. And that, you know, the three of us know, it is fascinating to me, the longer I parent, the longer I work with kids and families, that we pour in the same genetic ingredients every time, and the outcome is so profoundly different. Like, it's mind-blowing. Yeah. And I've always believed in that for as long as I've studied temperament, never more than I have being a parent of twins, that I have these two kids who were born within 3 minutes of each other. They share gender. They have the same two parents. They've lived in the same bedroom their entire lives. They go to the same school. And they are completely different beings. And, you know, it's my job to lean in and study the unique way this guy's made, the unique way this guy's made. And so I think in my mind, that's where it starts for us as dads, that intentional journey. And then I might add to that, I think in addition to studying development and temperament, I think a challenge for us is to study enjoyment, like to figure out in these different moments of our kids' life, like what's
great.
Their language, like that's what's great. Their world. And you know, we're doers and conquerors. And I'll say this, my experience has been that dads kind of swing to one side or the other. Like, they're all about play and maybe have a hard time settling into the everyday, you know, hearing your wife saying, I need you to be a part of homework too.
Or swing
the other direction where they're so task oriented that it's hard for them to just roll up their sleeves, and be about enjoyment. And so I've heard a lot of stories over the years of boys who've said things to me. This breaks my heart every time I hear it. You know, a boy who would say something like, I don't love riding home from a game with my dad. I would rather ride with my mom. And I know what's going to come next, but I always ask, you know, tell me more about that. And, you know, it's often some version of, because he's going to tell me everything I did wrong or everything I need to do better. And so I think we can easily shift into that coaching, instructing posture. And miss enjoyment. I mean, I've had boys say it's not even fun to play horse with him in the driveway, you know, because he'll turn every moment of basketball into a coaching session. And so that would be one challenge I would give to dads, of just making sure you're studying enjoyment. And there are moments where there's no other agenda than just showing up and being present, as you were saying.
I was talking to a friend about this last night. Do you find, especially with first boys and dads, that there's this is my chance to perfect what I did wrong? Mm-hmm. In that first son, where you go, everything I missed, you will catch.
Yes.
Every game I lost, you'll win. And we were laughing because this friend of mine's a really competitive, you know, like he's a three, he grew up. And he's just doing such a good job not doing that. And I said, why do you think that is? He said, well, for me, I think I don't have a lot of unfinished business that way. Like he said, I had some big wins as a high schooler, and I feel like satiated in some ways. But my problem is, we laugh because he's doing a great job of that. It's like, you know, I feel like my problem is going to be to overcorrect the other way, to just always never push, to just, hey, you did your best. And where Annie, who is the most competitive human being you'll ever meet, my wife, you know, we laughed so hard. We went and saw Covenant, you know, these kids who are in fifth, sixth grade playing basketball. And she cried when one of them hit a three-pointer. We got home and literally she was like, Dave, we're screwed with our kids. If we have any, like, you know, because she's going to really lean
Not
in.
Not a single kid on that court belongs to you to, guys.
And she was
she's crying.
Visibly crying. Yep. Like, she turned around and was like, wasn't that great? I was like, oh, boy. Oh, boy. But, you know, and we laughed about it that night. But, you know, I think we just had this really interesting conversation of realizing, like, there's this middle, like, because I don't want to be the dad that makes my kids, like, what'd you think? And I'm like, it was great. Mm-hmm. And you're doing, you know, but how do you live in that space where you encourage them and you're present and you can give instruction, but you're not being the dad that they,
them.
Yes, you're not living through them,
yeah.
Which is, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. Being present to realize that, to encourage them and to instruct them when needed, but also to give them space, mm-hmm. to me feels like so daunting, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which takes being present.
Seven. It does.
It takes every moment doing these check-ins.
It does.
Prayer, all the things of going, you know.
And awareness. And, you know, I think that's another reason I love the tool of the Enneagram, because it just allows you to connect some dots in terms of understanding your hardwiring and the way you bend and how you see the world, all those things. Because I really do believe that's hands down the greatest gift we can give our kids, is an awareness of ourselves, that I'm doing my own work and I'm aware of what's mine and not theirs and what I'm accidentally putting on them. And if there were one theme within this new book, it would be the theme of, we can only take the kids we love as far as we've gone ourselves. And so I
have
to be doing the work I need to do. So
hold on, would you say
they're
that
freed up? I will, that we can only take the kids we love as far as we've gone ourselves. And I think that's the Cliff Notes version.
That's a mic drop if there's ever been a mic drop on this podcast.
I believe it so strongly.
Good.
And Dave, you know what's so interesting? We do in a couple of other classes, we talk about that very phenomena that you described, that the longer that we do this work, and I think the longer I parent myself, we're aware that there is one kid in every family that flips your switch a little bit quicker. Like, there's one kid who has the capacity to do that. And often it is the oldest child of your same gender. And it's exactly what you described. Like, they are an extension of who you are to some degree. And you are seeing evidence of parts of you that you didn't love in yourself, you don't love in yourself, and you want to work out of them. Or if it's not the oldest child of your same gender, it's the child who's the most like you.
Yeah.
And there's something about either of those paths where, unless I'm aware of myself, unless I'm really dialed in, I can end up parenting that child harder than I parent my other kids.
Man.
Because I'm, you know, unconsciously trying to work something out in them.
Of myself.
And it's from oftentimes a healthy place of, I don't want you to struggle in the ways I did. I know where this road leads, like those kinds of things. But that's something we've got to pay attention to. Or I will take that child on an unfair journey.
That's a great word.
Requiring something more of them than is needed.
That's a great word.
We were talking last night about how it tends to be, I think you said that you tend to have like one parent who is sort of the unconditional love, and then the other parent is sort of like tells you the truth maybe a little more than the other parent. And that it tends to be, I feel like in my case, it was my dad was the one who would tell me the truth.
Yeah, so
my
please,
mom was the unconditional.
Please tell this story. This is fascinating.
The basketball story.
Yeah, because it's such a great, it goes in so well with that example he was saying.
So you may be surprised by looking at me, but I'm not that great of a basketball player. But when I was in about fifth, sixth grade, I'm from Indiana, so everyone plays basketball. I think like when you're born, they like put your little tiny baby hand on a basketball and they say a Larry Bird quote or something. So I'm playing basketball and, you know, it was one night where my dad and I were driving home from a game. This exact scenario that you described. We're driving home from the game and I didn't score any points that game. I don't remember the game specifically, but I know I didn't score any points because I don't think I ever scored any points in a basketball game ever. But I'm like distraught. I'm like so down on myself. And I'm sure after my dad has seen this game after game after game, you know, he's feeling for me. And he says, you know, you're not a great basketball player. Like the direct quote was, you're not a basketball player naturally by trade, you know. And that was like, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Like it hurt. Mm-hmm. That my dad is crushing my dreams of being Reggie Miller, you know. But I dropped the whole basketball thing. After that, I was able to sort of walk away from basketball. I mean, it sounds, I can barely say this with a straight face. Like, I have zero skill in basketball. But I needed my dad to just say, like, look, which he probably wanted to say this countless times before. And finally, he was like, I got to put my son out of his misery. Like, McLaughlins are not basketball players. Do you know any NBA star named McLaughlin? No. So, but my mom never would have said that. Like, where is the line there? And now that I'm a dad, I can look back and there are several of these moments growing up where, you know, my dad or someone else came in with some harsh words that was like some tough love and it helped me, but it hurt, you know? And especially now where we tend to, like, I'm leaning in hard with like every Lego thing that my daughter builds is the greatest Lego thing I have ever seen. You know, like that's, I think kind of like our generation's default is like everyone gets a trophy. Everyone. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Like, where is the line there?
Well, and I was so curious, and I'm so grateful you tell that story. Like, how does that land on you now? Like, are you glad he delivered absolutely. That news?
Do you wish he'd done it? And that's our relationship to this day.
Is it?
His words hold so much weight because I know he's telling me the truth.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get off stage and... If I'm playing a show and he's in the crowd, I'm aware of it the whole time. And when I get off stage, whatever he says to me is the truth, you know.
I do believe that kids arrive at a place, and I think it's different for every kid, where they start to see through our feedback and when it doesn't feel true.
Yeah.
And I think there is something valuable about us speaking. We talk a lot about naming, how we name kids at birth and then we name them throughout their lives too.
Man.
And I think one of the ways we name them is when we do tell them the truth and we allow them to grow into an understanding of where their strengths are and where they're not. And that there is something valuable about us helping them make those connections. And certainly there's a lot to be said for the delivery or the execution of that, but that they would, as you are describing, believe us to be truth tellers and that they can trust that information.
Because at some point, I'm assuming every child goes, man, I am not as good as that guy at this sport, guitar, at singing, at running, at painting, drawing, whatever. And I would think that's a pivotal moment for you to enter and go and tell the truth. Because if you don't, they're going to start associating you, oh, you don't love me enough to tell me the truth because I know the truth myself and you're not confirming that truth in me,
yes.
Right?
Yes,
and so, absolutely. So is that different for every kid or do you find that's around a certain time? I mean,
I think it is different for every kid and I would say I think temperament plays a big role in that. I do, and I think some kids are later to make those connections and I think it's, you know, our knowing them, how they see the world, how they operate in the world, to know that they might be later to make some of those connections. And my only job is to walk with them as they're doing that, but not to make it for them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great word.
Yeah.
So what is the damage of the sort of everybody gets a trophy? What is that line to walk? You know what I mean?
I think there is some damage on a couple of levels. And I think one is the very thing we're talking about. If kids don't experience us telling the truth, when we're just, you're doing everything in such an incredible way, and that's just not possible. Like, I don't think basketball is your thing.
Yeah.
I know you're well-intentioned, but please don't say that to me again. It still hurts so much.
There's a deep wound. You're just opening a scab.
But is there... I know it's hard to paint with a broad brush and just say, like, yes, 7 years old is when it's okay. But when they're so young, that's okay up until a certain point, right? And does it just come down to, like, you got to be around enough, you have to be involved enough to know your child, to know when, okay, this is a moment when I can start to, you know.
It's like you said, just kind of paying attention, like being astute.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, when they are realizing it first, then you can speak into the moment.
Absolutely.
Which sadly, you may have been a month away, but maybe you hadn't gotten there yet.
I hadn't got there yet. And I think my dad saw that I was never going to get there.
He was like, look, Rudy's a great movie, but in real life, that's tough. Rudy is tough. That's a tough way to go.
Do you think it's a part of what opened the door for you to put your foot on the accelerator with music? If you think about the timing.
You know, what's interesting. I mean, music was kind of a constant in my life. So it was almost like music was there so early that it was almost a given. Like, music is not a category like basketball is. Music is like breathing and basketball and swimming and social and all that kind of stuff.
Hoop dreams,
yeah, you know.
If you don't mind, David, I'd love to hear you too. Just for those who are listening, including ourselves, as you have kids that start to get into sports, because ours are still, you know, Ben is 7, so he's starting to do more of that. And even with, you know, ballet with John's girls or whatever, it could be obviously any sport, but I know they're doing ballet and gymnastics. Yeah. How does competition, how do you parent that when you have kids who are competitive or are in competitive sports and you're trying to sort of, how do you do that? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Gently. And, you know, the saddest part for me is youth sports is one of those areas, like so many areas, where I feel like the grown-ups have hijacked that experience and made it something different than what it was intended to be. Yes. So,
which can be said for almost everything.
It really is. Yeah. And I think that's where it's got to start, is whether that's choosing a particular league because we feel it doesn't move as much in that direction, or the grown-ups who are in charge are more balanced in their perspective. So I think it starts there.
Quote, unquote.
Good point.
The coaches are more balanced.
Oh, my goodness. And so I think it's doing a lot of studying there. And in addition to watching, you know, our kids' kind of natural bent, but I can't tell you the number of families I've worked with or consulted with whose kids have bowed out of an experience that I think could have been more valuable for them because it had been robbed of a lot of the things that youth sports should always be on some level. Like, it just should be about learning skills, being with your friends, being active, having fun. And we've stripped away so much of that where I feel like kids can't get the good stuff sometimes because there's an intensity, and maybe more so in different regions of the country, but we're living in one that does that. And so I think we have to pay really close attention so that kids can keep enjoying and savoring the good stuff that comes from that, and without the grown-ups taking away what was meant to be.
Which is terrifying.
Yeah, it really is. Can I read something to you all too? I was thinking as we were having this conversation together about truth-telling, and it made me think of it when I threw that word out, naming. I read this book, gosh, I don't even know how many years ago now, well over a decade, but it was a book called The Middle Place. Have either of you read that book? Sorry. It's written by a woman named Kelly Corrigan, and it's a book about her relationship with her dad. And she would, years later, write a book called Glitter and Glue about her relationship with her mom. But in this book, in The Middle Place, she's diagnosed with breast cancer, and then soon after, her dad's diagnosed with cancer. And so it's kind of their journey together, and a lot about their relationship. But I pulled this up because I wanted to to read this with you all. I love these words so much, but this is from the introduction. She's talking about her dad. She said, "He makes me feel smart, funny, and beautiful, which has become the job of the few men who have loved me since. He told me once that I was a great talker, and so I was. I was a conversationalist, along with creative, a notion he put in my head when I was in grade school and used to make huge, intricate collages from his old magazines. He defined me first as parents do. Those early characterizations can become the shimmering self-image we embrace or the limited, stifling perception we rail against for a lifetime. In my case, he sees me as I would like to be seen. In fact, I'm not even sure what's true about me since I have always chosen to believe his version."
Good gracious.
And I love those words.
As you're reading that, I'm curious. I want to know your thoughts on that. Because when she said, you know, he once said I was a great talker, and so I was.
Yeah.
I hear that and I think, did that just coincidentally happen, like the stars aligned there? Or, you know, because I think I don't want to put on some undue, like, Luca, you are this. Mm-hmm. Daddy mm-hmm. thinks you're this. And then, you know, 30 years later, she's in counseling because she's not that. Yeah. But dad yeah. said I was that.
He said I was a basketball yeah. player.
WNBA all the way. What do you, in your experience, am I putting too much power in my words? You know what I mean?
I think it's a great question. I think that excerpt speaks to the power of our words. And I think that, even going back, Dave, to your question about being intentional as a dad, I think that would be one of the challenges I would give dads too, of just be so aware of the power of your words. And that I do think we name kids in really helpful ways and harmful ways at times. But I love that, because that to me is such a picture of where we can do that in truthful ways. If you were to read that book, and I would so encourage you all to, if you get a chance, it's beautiful. Yeah. It's breathtaking. But, you know, going back to that statement a little bit earlier about studying enjoyment, this dad like knocked it out of the park. Like he delighted in, you remember when Sissy talked about that, of girls who feel delighted in are more delightful. And I think she is such a picture as an adult woman of, I've met Kelly before, and you couldn't help but have that experience and bumping up against her, like someone delighted in you, you know, from early
God,
on. And you felt, and it felt genuine, not false. There was truth telling. There was all these things we're talking about. And therefore, I think he named the things that were true because he knew her and he studied her and called those out, you know, just called out. And so I think it's hard to miss. Sorry, that's a long answer to your question, but I think it's hard to miss when we're doing that, leaning in that way. Like if I'm really studying my kids, what's going on developmentally, what's going on in terms of their temperament and enjoying them, we can't help but call out the truthful things because we know them.
As long as we are aware that we are not making it our thing.
There it is. And that's where
that's
right
back to.
That's
been a real common theme as we've been doing this podcast. I don't think it's really something that I've thought much about going into being a dad. How easily we snap back to just ourselves, self-centeredness. And I think we do it in all social scenarios. If someone, not even just your kids, but if someone reacts a certain way, you think, I did something to make them do that, you know. But how, it's been a common theme, how easily if, you know, if I feel like I'm concerned about something my kids are doing or not doing, I need to check myself to make sure this is not just an issue that I have personally. They're not struggling with anything, you know. So A, just being present with your kids, knowing your kids, and B, making sure you're not putting some undue failed basketball dream on them.
Hoop there
dreams.
It is.
Hashtag hoop dreams.
Guys, today's episode is brought to you by That Sounds Fun Network, as are all Dadville episodes released every other week. And today, we want to share another podcast that is part of this awesome family. I don't even call it a network. I call it a family.
That's what I call it, too.
The podcast that launched it all, the That Sounds Fun podcast with Annie F. Downs.
And what does F stands for?
Freaking fun.
What does F stand for even more? Freaking fun. Double
freaking
F.
Freaking fun. Mm-hmm.
Every Monday and Thursday, Annie sits down and shares fun conversations with friends of all sorts. Authors, musicians, faith leaders, and more. We even got to sit down with Annie a time or two, and oh boy, it's fun.
I knew you were going to say fun.
Thank you. Annie is so loving and thought-provoking, and I think you'll really love her podcast.
Think of it like being a fly on the wall listening to a conversation friends are having over coffee, or tea, or soda, or water, or soda water.
Ooh.
It's almost... It's almost always a fun time.
There's one out of 100 that are super bummed out.
It's always a fun time. Listen to conversations with Bear Reinhart from Need to Breathe, musical icon Amy Grant, and NFL football player Sam Acho.
So if you want to add a little variety into your podcast life, check out That Sounds Fun podcast with Annie Downs. Just search for That Sounds Fun on your favorite podcast platform. Check it out because, quite frankly... It sounds fun. So, something I was going to ask earlier, there was such a pivotal moment for me sort of in my 20s when I realized these consistencies in myself and my friends. And it was what family we came from, the dynamics of the family. And it was this really revelatory moment for me of going, gosh, all of my friends that had to go through divorced families seem to struggle with these same things. All of my friends that came from these kind of families seem to struggle with these kind of things. And it was my first little foray into kind of just psychology of going like, oh, there's kind of these consistencies of pain, encouragement, people I knew that were delighted in, all of these things. You know, I think something I've really struggled with over the last, you know, that I think God is really trying to shift a little bit of my paradigm of this, but is I've been just sort of carte blanche, like, oh, if this is what you came from, you're going to be like this. If you're like this, and Annie's always pushed really hard back on this with me because I can give too much power to parents of like, oh, well, if that's, let me hear, oh, and it's okay, your parents did this to you or whatever. And I think something as I get older, I'm realizing is that's very true. And I think, you know, obviously, you know, so much counseling is so helpful in going, let's talk about your family. And that's going to inform a lot. But I think something I would love to hear you speak on, especially as you meet with kids and know that world so well. Annie has always said there's also such a big part of their social life of who their friends are, who their parents of their friends are, that start to speak into this experience. Because I think for me, if I have some struggle, for example, and I'm going, why do I do this? My first instinct is to go, okay, what do I know about my parents and what they did with that? Is this something they did? Is this something they, and I'm just sort of realizing like, yeah, that might be true, but there's all these other people in your life that inform that too. And this is a really bizarre way to ask this, but do you think there's some percentage of that? Like, do you find that parents are 40 and life's 60, or, you know, and that's a bizarre way to ask, but I think for my brain and what I think about, that would help me and sort of as I think about myself, because, you know, I've just laughed with so many friends how much I feel like we need to apologize to our parents because the first counseling you do, I think you leave with this machete. And you just drive to your parents' house and they go, how's your day? And you're like, oh, you don't, you know, like you just take your machine gun out and you're like, you did all this stuff, you know. And some of that's true. I mean, you know, and I think great parents, present parents go, yeah, like I did that. I'm sorry. I did these things, you know, but I think it's sort of sad because it's like I laughed with my brother about this. Like, it's like we should have to sign contracts after you get done with your first counseling session. Says, please don't go and talk to your parents about this until you've landed your planes and then go have a great, you know, because it's just, you just feel so empowered. It's like suddenly you've found your pain and why, you know. And so I think for me, I'm just curious, what is that sort of continuum? How do you find that affects kids? And I think especially as parents, as dads and moms listen to this or whatever, how do we understand what we're contributing and what we're not? Mm. And what are the other voices and how much they impact that too, you know? I just gave you a million things at once.
Oh, that's great.
That's
stuff.
My gift.
I want to think about it. I would say first off, I think it's always both. And I think it's more of one for some people and less for others. I think it has a lot to do with, this is kind of right back to where we were a few minutes ago, the amount of work that a person has done to where they're aware of that they're operating out of some place they're either aware of or they're not aware of. And so I would say the percentage is always going to be higher for a parent I'm working with who's not aware, hasn't done that work. Mm. And then I think the other is, I keep going back to the Enneagram, but some tool that allows you to figure out more about how you operate in the world so that you stop assuming that your children are triggering something in you and you assume, I just get triggered in these places. Yeah. And then I think going beyond that to identify, what do I need to know about how I operate in the world that I would then establish some practices in my own journey of parenting so that I can make sure I'm being who I want to be in these moments. Like for a great example is years ago I heard Suzanne Stabile, who wrote The Road Back to You, talk about for a one that it would be a good idea for you to not go in your children's rooms more than once or twice a week.
No, just because you're going to want to tidy.
Exactly. Isn't that amazing? Like, I remember just, I couldn't even write that down. I was so struck by that. And the truth of that and how I, you know, as reformers, I walk into any space in my house and I automatically see what needs to be done, what's wrong. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I do that with my children. I think, oh my gosh, I don't want their childhood to be defined by me walking in the room and first words out of my mouth, pick up those clothes.
Right, so
that's but one example of where I think those percentages are going to be different to the degree that I'm dialed into those things.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think as kids get older, their friends begin to matter more. To y'all's class the other day, and the kids' parents matter more. And I think if the kids have parents who you know and you trust, it's wonderful because they're going to take in things that you're telling them differently. Sometimes they're just going to take them in at all with somebody else that they never take in from you. How much do you see that affecting kids too? How much does that
become? A lot in adolescents, a lot.
Yeah.
And this is even back to the importance of studying development. To the degree that I know that, like the tendency that I'll see with parents in that season when our voice is getting softer and our kids are hearing less from us, it's not that they're not hearing from us, but they're hearing less, just as was true for all of us. The tendency for parents in that stage is to talk louder and talk more. And you couldn't go in a worse direction, as opposed to, I really want to usher in other adult, healthy voices who are going to get away with saying things to my kids that I can't.
That's a great word.
And so I think to the degree that I know that's going on, and that's not a fail on my part. It's just what it is. It's just what happens. And
you can't fight it.
No.
Yeah.
And I need to celebrate it. And I can remember when my daughter, my oldest, got an opportunity to write this column it was in a national publication, and I was so proud of her. And she is the writer in our house. Like, she writes circles around me. And yet I thought, okay, this is a moment where I feel like I could bring something to the table. And so I said, sweetheart, if you want to brainstorm on some ideas, like, I would love to do that with you. And I write a column in a magazine, so I thought I could be helpful. And she looked at me. I mean, she was 16 at the time. And she was trying so hard not to hurt my feelings, but she was like, thanks, Dad, but I've already talked to Miss Stenton about that. And Miss Stenton was her blonde, beautiful English teacher at the time who she loved. And I felt so deflated in that moment. And then I could jump out of that a few minutes later and just say, of course she would want to. I would want to talk to her too if I were a 16-year-old girl. Yeah. But I think knowing that's going on, it's not about me in that moment. It didn't have a thing to do with me.
So,
I don't believe.
So you didn't walk in and just start stacking your books up in front of her, just silently?
I wanted to so bad. Finally, I can bring something to the table and you won't access it.
It seems like a good way to look at the arc of your kids' time in your house is maybe like, I hear you say that and I think, okay, this is how I'm going to look at it. I've got them until they're 12, 13. At that point, something's going to switch, right? And they're going to want to go to, whoever. That hopefully, if best case scenario, everything that my wife and I have done will then be reinforced by other adults in their lives, or other kids maybe in their lives.
Yes.
And then our job slightly shifts a little more to we're upper level management now. We're the executive producers now.
Right.
And we kind of make sure that what are the players in the scene here?
Yes.
And probably like you're saying, the worst thing you could do would be to fight that and to want to get back down in the trenches and just speak louder.
Yes.
And another common theme that I feel like we have heard over and over again that has been a major thing for me is that kids are not listening to you. They're not, and you wrote this in your book, kids learn by observation, mm-hmm. not by what you tell them.
Right.
Well, you probably wrote that a lot better than I just said it, but that's been huge for me. I think about that every day over the past couple months, because beforehand I was putting so much pressure on myself to say these like little nuggets of wisdom that I would gift down to my daughters, you know. And I'm sure in the adolescent years, as they start to push back against that, and not only are they not listening, but the eyes are starting to roll, et cetera, that I'm just, you know, I got to remember to not fight that, not fight against that, not start screaming those words, you know. So,
well, gee, I love that, John, because it gives you a, like, again, if you know what's coming, you can brace for it and be prepared as opposed to being overwhelmed. And if you really start to go, okay, we really, I mean, Annie and I thought we were just going to hold each other and cry when y'all said during your session, you know, the sweetest time of we've agreed for our children is if you could just freeze them in that like 4 to 7. And I was like, oh, no. What does that mean? What about, because, you know, we've got two that hadn't got, well, two that are, one is 4 and then 1's 7. And I'm like, oh, great. So one's leaving. Mm. We're about to lose him to the world. But, you know,
already. Yeah.
But at the same time going, okay, if I can prepare myself for this, I enjoy this more. I'm more present. I'm more prepared for what's coming next, you know. And when they come in and again and you get that first side hug, you go, yeah, okay, like this is
good for me to hear this today. Because when it's going to come, maybe it won't destroy me quite as much.
I'll give you a front hug if that just coming back in the studio, okay. Walk across the street, and I will frontal hug assail you.
Okay. We'll talk about it.
One of the things that I really appreciate about what y'all do too, Dave, and you've talked about this in so many of your books and during y'all's session the other day, is the emotions. Mm-hmm. Like how to, in fact, Annie and I bought the emotions.
The
feelings chart. Annie and I were talking last night, and she, because I was kind of like, what are some other things you would love to hear? And she spoke, that's all, it's great. It feels like sometimes one of the things that she and I are trying to do better and understand is, as you help your kids understand feelings, the thing that she said I thought was really intuitive, how do you walk that line of helping them understand they're sad, mommy's sad, daddy's lonely, whatever those are, which lonely may be a little hot for their ages, but you know, somewhere they can go, oh, and then at the same time, how do you sort of navigate not giving them too much responsibility for how you feel? In other words, like, you made mama sad, which hopefully you never say, but you know, because emotions and feelings are so powerful, and navigating that world without giving them too much ownership in it, at least of themselves, they need to have, but of a understanding they can affect other people, but I would assume there's probably an age where it's kind of like, yeah, you don't want to sort of implement that too soon because they'll think, oh my God, I can like crush my dad and I don't want to do that. You know, how do you navigate that?
Mm-hmm. We talk about when we teach the class on this new book and we jump into the section on the emotional milestones, we talk about kind of three guidelines that we hope can be helpful for parents in framing that journey, taking the emotional journey with our kids. And the first is that feelings are just feelings. Mm. Like most of us grew up being told that they're good feelings, like happy, and bad feelings, like sad. And right. That's just not true. It's not helpful. It's not true. It is good to be sad at times when we're grieving. I lost my mom a little over a year ago, and I felt overwhelming amounts of sadness in the last year, which is a good thing for me to experience because of who she was in my life. And so we want to help kids figure that out. Like, they're just feelings, and they do just that. They come and go. When they don't go, you know, when we feel trapped sometimes in those is when we want to figure out, what do I need to do in this moment? And maybe I need to pull somebody else in to help me travel a few miles forward. The second guideline we talk a lot about is and this is kind of funny, that feelings are like children. You cannot stuff them in the trunk of the car, but you don't want them driving either. You know, where are kids? The safest in a vehicle is in the back seat, fastened in. Like, I'm aware of them. They're with me, but they're not in charge of me. And right. I'm not pretending like they're not there.
Right.
And I think that's key to your question, both for ourselves and to stay in check that I'm not giving my children something that's just not theirs. And I was even thinking too, when you were sharing about being a four earlier, you know, just that I think that's a harder journey I find for a lot of fours, because there is an intensity to what you feel, which is beautiful and extraordinary, and I would imagine is a huge part of what makes you so gifted in what you do vocationally. And yet there could be times where it feels like the feelings have the steering wheel in a lot of moments of life in ways I don't want them to. So I think that's such an important thing, I think, that we're helping kids make connections around, and that sometimes they are. They're just going to feel more in charge of us than we are in charge of them. But back to your question with those guidelines, figuring out in life, we talk about how if we could, you know, water down all four of the emotional milestones into like the Cliff Notes version, it would be helping kids figure out what do I feel and what to do with it. And this world, unfortunately, is full of grown-ups who never figured out those two things. Like, they cannot identify what they feel, and they certainly can't figure out something constructive. And so it's why we in this country lead the statistics for substance abuse, infidelity, eating disorders, internet pornography. We go on and on, all these destructive directions that we go to try to numb out whatever it is that we're feeling or make that stop in some way. And so it isn't a responsibility, but I think it's a great privilege we have as parents to take that journey with our kids and help them figure out, hey, I am feeling sad right now, and here's what that's about. And so doing that work on a daily basis, even going back to what you shared a little bit earlier, realizing that kids are learning more from observation than information, I think even them hearing us say things like, I felt really sad today, and so I called my friend Dave, and, you know, we went on a walk for 2 hours. Exactly. Yeah, and it helped me so much to be able to talk with a trusted friend. So I don't think kids get to hear enough of that. I would say for us as fathers, I don't think boys in this world get to hear nearly enough of that, that they grow up with this sense of emotions reside in the life of a man, and here's what it looks like to attend to that in a healthy way. So I want that. Generally speaking, I think we're doing a much better job with giving girls permission to feel and what to do with that. But I think we've got a long way to go. And that's part of why I think this book felt so important for us. And you know, talking about statistics, if we look at what we're seeing in youth culture, you know, like the stats are off the charts right now. We have the highest rates of childhood and adolescent depression we've had at any other time in history. Anxiety is now considered to be a childhood epidemic in our country. Like, we have the highest rates. And if we go even deeper into that, you know, what we're seeing in our practice, I think what's happening in the world around us, is evidence of where kids can't articulate their experience accurately. I think when the three of us were growing up, and you guys are clearly younger than I am, but when I was growing up, I remember if you wanted to really get at your parents, like if you were struggling on the inside and you wanted to say the worst thing you could think to say, you would say, I'm going to run away from home. And we might have even packed a bag and gone to the end of the street and then come back.
Yep.
You know, I cannot remember a time in the last 10 years that I've heard a kid say, or a parent report that a kid said, I'm going to run away from home. But what do they say now? I'm going to kill myself. You know, we have kids as young as 7 and 8 who say that with regularity. And so it's their way of saying, I have this storm going on inside of me, but I don't know what to do with it. I don't know what it is, and I don't know what to do with it. So helping kids learn to articulate their experience. And then the second milestone we talk about is the milestone of perspective, and helping them figure out how to categorize life accurately. That a 1 is losing my car keys, a 10 is losing a family member. But we see kids who are slamming up against 10 over everything because they can't categorize life. And then the third milestone is the milestone of empathy, which is this well-researched, game-changing foundational ingredient that we know is so vital to all healthy interpersonal relationships, spouse to spouse, parent to child, coworker to coworker, friend to friend. Like, it is a game changer. And so the third milestone, emotional milestone, is that. And then the fourth one is resourcefulness, which is just taking the emotion to something constructive. That's that figuring out what to do. And so circling around those four milestones, I think, is one of the more important parts of parenting in this day and age.
When I think about that, I think about 2 and 4. And question I have for 2 is, how do you help a child understand what those emotions are and how to number them, if you will, without belittling? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you sort of guide them through, like, hey, bud, I know y'all lost the game, for example, and you feel like life is ending, but it's not without them going, like, you don't understand. You know, like, how do you do that?
Yeah. I think it actually starts with a feelings chart. I love that you all got one of those, and that even kids who can't read, that they're pointing to those faces with some consistency and figuring it out. And then in a non-problematic time, we love creating a 1 to 10 scale. Like, we'll even have parents do it with dry erase markers on the other side of that laminated feelings chart. And when it's calm and things are normal, you sit down and just say, let's figure out, what is a 1? What's a 1 in your world? You know, what's a 5? What's an 8? What's a 10? And there, we're writing that out with them. And so that when they're feeling that storm of emotions, we can say, what does that feel like today? And then even handing that back to them for them to look at and use as a point of reference, knowing that, you know, depending on the day and where they are and how much sleep they've had and have they had a snack, all those things are going to be factors. But they could, over time, more accurately say, you know what, actually losing the game today felt like a 4. And feel much higher than that. Or, I mean, I've known kids who are growing in an amazing way in this area who said it felt like a 7 right afterwards, but tonight it doesn't feel any higher than a 3. Like, I think that's remarkable. Like, if an 8-year-old could do that, have some perspective, some distance, even figure out what they might need to do over the afternoon to kind of work through a hard loss, and then come back and say, actually, no, that loss didn't feel any higher than a 3. I know grown-ups who can't do that work.
Yeah.
Like, that's phenomenal. Right. Yeah, that's amazing to me.
And then with 4, do you feel, like, I know Sage Hill, you know, Stephen is a dear friend, and we've had Stephen on. I know you guys have written some books and are good buds. But one of the things that I remember Stephen saying to me early on in counseling, he said, you know, one of the things that he said, I have found that I encourage people when they are feeling whatever they're feeling is usually they either need time alone, time with people, or time with the Lord. And so when you think about that with kids, to your fourth point, do y'all kind of have a list of things, or is it kind of, is it a lot of things? Do y'all kind of go, hey, here are the few ways we see we can get, we can move, we can, you know.
We do. We have kids make an actual list. And some of that is, you know, kids pre-12 are in terms of their cognitive development, they're in what we call concrete thinking. So the world's very black and white. So when they can make a list and then see it, that's so helpful to them. And then if they're feeling, you know, some intensity around those emotions, we talk a lot. We do some kind of brain 101 with kids where we talk about when we're feeling a lot of emotions, you know, throughout the day, we all three have blood flow going on in our heads. And the majority of that blood flow right now for the three of us while we're having this conversation is hovering around the frontal lobes, which helps us manage emotions. You know, when we are experiencing some intensity in life, it moves back to the back of the brain toward the amygdala, that fight or flight part. And so we're not in our, with kids we'll call it, we're not in our thinking brain anymore, we're in our dinosaur brain. And so how do we get back to our thinking brain? And having it on a list is helpful, because then if I'm in my dinosaur brain, I don't even have to do all that brainstorming, like, what were my three things? What was the one that worked the best? It's on a list hanging up somewhere. And that's even to go back to your point about where kids are observing. We encourage parents to do that. Like, have a note card that you put on your bathroom mirror with 5 things that help you. Walking the dog, talking with mom, you know, whatever it may be, that are your 5 coping skills you're working with.
So those would be particular to the kids.
They
so
would
you'll
be.
Find, because I would imagine with extrovert, introvert, that's going to change with, you know, yeah, that's a great word.
Absolutely. And so we walk families through in the 4th chapter of how to do that, again, in a non-problematic time. Where
that's awesome.
You all sit down and do it together as a family, and they can see, again, this is not just true for kids, it's true for grown-ups. We all need to be about this.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, when kids are hospitalized, when you are on an adolescent unit, they won't discharge you from any adolescent unit until you have a list of 100 coping skills. That's like a prerequisite. That's true for every single person. And it's just this reality of you need to have 100. So you can at least hit 1 or 2 that's going to work with some consistency. But, you know, it's that reminder. That's what we all need to be about in all moments, like figuring out, what do I feel? What do I do with it? And we talk with kids about having, you know, part of having a resilient mindset is figuring out if something worked at one point and it no longer works, then I scratch that off the list and replace it with something else.
Wow.
That's wisdom.
Wow.
But knowing even that's going to change developmentally over time. Something that maybe worked great when I was 10 might not work so great when I'm 17.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. That's a great point.
It's funny how when I was reading through your book and everything that you're describing right now, it's like, this is so helpful for me. And I need it in the way that you present it to children that works. that's watered down, that works for me. Mm-hmm. I need just a couple simple little steps.
Me too.
And when I was reading your book, and you're talking about children regulating their emotions, can your child regulate their emotions? I mean, I'm thinking two things. One, can I regulate my emotions? Like you said, and we were talking about earlier, I'm a four, so like my emotions are in the, maybe they're not driving all the time, but they're like backseat drivers at worst.
Or they're trying to climb over the backseat.
They're climbing over the backseat, yes. And that's like, that's how I live my life, mm-hmm. you know, like that's, I at best I'm using that in a useful way, but also I'm of course thinking like, gosh, my kids are, okay, Luca's six, like, did she have a temper tantrum the other day? Like, I read something in your book where it was something specific to like a temper tantrum or throwing a fit or something like that. And I'm literally thinking back to like, okay, last week, Luca, she was upset about that thing because I didn't let her have a cookie before bed. Was that a temper tantrum? Yeah, she did that thing with her foot, so that's a temper tantrum. Like, I'm basically wanting you to tell me, like, John, you're fine. Your kids are great. They're doing great. They're too young for this now. Like, you're crushing it as a dad. If you could just say these things back to me. But is there...
Hold on, I'm writing them down.
Get a ringtone. And I'll have you say them in multiple different ways.
But accent.
Is there like a, like we were saying earlier, like adolescence, that's a real like marker in their life. Adolescence is sort of like a line in the sand almost. Is there something before that emotionally where it's like, yeah, if your child's three, they're just not going to have the tools to regulate their emotions. Certainly. So don't judge them by these markers
certainly.
Yet. And where is that?
Yeah.
And is it different for boys versus girls?
It is.
Typically.
Yeah. Typically, and certainly there are exceptions to every rule, but typically girls are going to be advanced.
Just better at it. Yeah.
They're going to be more intuitive. Their awareness of their own emotions and those of others is oftentimes going to be stronger. And so we end up needing to take these steps a little bit earlier with the girls in our lives, but I think we can wait too long with a lot of boys and assume they don't have their thumb on the pulse of a family in ways they often do.
Yeah.
But so much, to answer your question, so much of what's happening with kids that young is what we call co-regulation. So we're doing it with them, we're doing it beside them, we're even doing it for them. And so in chapter two, we introduce this concept of the space. We call it the space, and then we talk a little bit more about it in chapter four, and I'll give you the Cliff Notes version, but it's basically where we'd carve out, you know, some corner of a playroom or a mud room, or it could be a kid's bedroom. I think it's ideal when it's a universal space where anybody in the family could go in any given moment, and we feel that, this is again going back to studying temperament, what would work best for that particular kid? If they're Ben is more toward being artistic, maybe a bucket with a journal or some paper and crayons or markers, whatever. Maybe it's a kid I talk a lot with for many boys, but this can be true for girls. There is a physicality to their emotions, and so it's why toddler-age boys are a little more prone to biting, kicking, screaming, hitting. It's why adolescent boys are a little more prone to punching holes in drywall. So part of that is a boy's way of saying, I need a physical release. And so in the space, we'll fill that with, you know, a mini trampoline that they can jump on and get some of that intensity out. When my twin boys were little, we got a Bozo Bop It. Did either of you have one of those growing up? Like, it has sand in the bottom and it's inflatable and you can bop it and
it bounces back up.
So we moved to, when they were in elementary school, a kickstand. I got it, play it again sports. And we now have a full body bag hanging in our basement. We look like we're training boxers over at the Thomas household. And we've been working with this over time, and it's not uncommon. My twins are 16. My daughter's 18 now. It's not uncommon that I would come home and walk through the front door, and the first sounds I would hear would be punching and grunting.
Yeah.
And then if I give that a little time, what do you think is the next sound I might hear from that space? It's often crying. And if I go down and, you know, check in on that kid who's downstairs, I've heard every story imaginable of, you know, feeling betrayed by a friend, didn't get picked for a team, failed a test I thought I prepared well for. You know, I came down one day and my daughter was down there, and she doesn't use it as often as my sons do, but she was punching and yelling, I hate girl drama. I hate girl drama. And I I think, don't we all hate adolescent girl drama? You know, and right. She just had a day with friends and, you know, things went off the rails. And I love that felt instinctive when she walked in the door. But we've been at it for over a decade. So that's not that I'm doing something great. We just have been doing it in front of each other. And I introduced this concept. And again, we've got a roadmap for it in the book to a family I was working with years ago. And the parents came in for a consultation. They came in about a month later to follow up. And I said, did you guys have a chance to test drive the space? And they were like, we did. And honestly, the kids have taken to it better than I think I thought they would. Their kids were 6 and 8 at the time. And the wife said, but it's been a game changer in my marriage. And I was taken by that. I wasn't expecting her to say that. And her husband laughed and she was like, yeah, she sends me there all the time. And
that's
amazing. Isn't that amazing? She said, David, this woman knows me. We've been married for 15 years. She can read my body and know a lot about the kind of day I've had just by looking at me when I walk in the door. And she will sometimes say, hey, kids, dad looks like he's had a stressful day. He's going to go to the space for a little bit, and then he'll join us for dinner. So she was sending him there with regularity.
Grunting and crying.
Exactly. But you know what he said? I love this. I love how he told on himself. I'll never forget him saying this. He said, David, 2 weeks before you even introduced that idea to us, he said, I have a vivid memory of driving home, stuck in traffic. I was late. I raced to the table because I wanted to be with my family. My 6-year-old son, who's very animated, was in the middle of telling this story, and he knocked over glass of milk, and he said, I lost it. Like, went off the deep end over spilled milk. And I'm 100% convinced I shame this little boy that I love. All because, which is, I love what you said earlier, he said, all because I realized, like, I didn't have a coping skills list. We didn't have a space. I needed the space more than anybody in the house. And I wasn't doing it in front of him. So, of course, he was having moments where he looked so dysregulated because he didn't get to see his dad regulating himself. Yeah. And so I love, I go back to those parents telling me that story, and I love that he told on himself in that way, and that he was aware that where this journey needed to start, where it needs to start for all of us, is that I'm doing it in front of my kids, and they're seeing evidence again of this is what it looks like to be a grown-up and to have feelings and to figure out what to do with it. And I'm going to put my note card on the mirror, too, and be practicing. Let's do it together.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, it's a lot of co-regulating, doing it with them. And even them hearing us say things like, you know, I don't know if this would help or not, but it helps me a lot when I love how many schools, high schools and colleges are bringing in therapy dogs during exams for kids, because we're, you know, we've now done a lot of research around that and figured out the brain science around what it does to our cortisol when we are petting an animal, you know? And so many kids will instinctively do that with their pets. And you all just affirm, any parent listening, like affirm, like, isn't it amazing? And we have all this data in to tell us what happens when we're petting our animals at this point and how it does calm our bodies and our brains. So helping kids just figure out with the stuff they've got laying around what's most helpful for them in this journey.
You know, when our girls were younger and we were trying to figure out, you know, discipline, and we do the timeout thing a lot.
Great.
And I remember when Luca, our oldest, was young, you know, 2 years old or something like that, it just made sense. Like, why don't we make timeout her crib? It's a cage we can put her in and she can't get out, you know? And my wife was like, well, I don't want her bed to feel like a place of, like when we put her to bed at night, I don't want her to be like, oh, am I in trouble right now? Which made a lot of sense, and we didn't do that. But I wonder if the cure for that, for having a space where you go when you need to, you know, have a timeout, quote unquote, is them seeing the parents have a place as well.
Yes.
And then it takes the shame out of it.
Yes.
You know?
Well, and that's a great distinction, and we talk about that in the roadmap of if you have a timeout chair, a naughty step, or you know anything, not letting that be in this space for the very reason you name. Like, we don't want kids making that connection that when I have feelings, I have to go.
Feelings are bad.
Exactly.
Right.
So those are separate. The timeout chair is in a different spot. And this is, as you said, just a place where anybody in the family can go when they just need a few minutes.
Yeah.
Because what's interesting is, you know, what kids will most instinctively do is this pattern in my field that we call anchoring. And it's It's back to that age-old saying of misery loves company. You know, that when I feel a storm raging inside of me, I would like for you to feel miserable too. Yeah. And so I'm going to anchor myself to you. It's what young children do. It's what adolescents will continue to do unless they're trained toward, you know, figuring out what those things are for them, moving toward resourcefulness. But this sense of I'm going to anchor myself to you, I'm going to follow you around the house and just fall apart. I show this hilarious YouTube video of a toddler-aged child, and the mom turns her camera on, and the child is just melting down, rolling all over the floor. And then she leaves the room, like walks out with the camera, and the crying stops. And he walks around the corner. As soon as he sees her again, he just collapses on the floor and starts the whole thing. You've all probably seen it. And I show that as an example. That's what's most instinctive for kids unless we're training them towards something different, towards self-soothing, toward coping skills, that they'll just keep anchoring over and over.
Yeah. One of the things that that I was curious about is, and this may be an unfair question, so please know that you may go, no, that's you're asking this wrong. But what do you think are the biggest differences in how a dad and mom affect their children?
No, I think it's a very fair question. And I think there's something important about noting, even as you're asking that question, that we bring really different things to the table. Some similar things, but some different things. And that's ideal in my mind. I'm so glad that's the case. And I'm always cautious that we would only work within the categories of, you know, women are more nurturing and men are more, you know, those kinds of things, because I want us to be some of both. I want kids to experience that. But I do think it has been my experience that a lot of dads bring the gift of risk and helping kids be courageous to the journey of parenting in a remarkable way that isn't as instinctive for a lot of moms. And I think there's just something in them that wants to protect and keep them safe, and we help them risk. And I think that looks different on a 3-year-old than it does with a 13-year-old, but I think it's beautiful. I really do. And I think there is, to that category of nurture and mercy, I think there's something in the way that moms instinctively offer that to kids that fascinates me, how they experience that differently. And I go all the way back to when my twins were learning to walk. We were around the corner at Sevier Park one day, and we were walking. My wife and I were walking backwards, and they were doing that kind of stumbling. Yeah. We were really just waiting on them to fall. And both of them were walking toward us, and my son, Baker, who was closest to me, fell. And he looked up, and it was that moment, you know, we have with our kids where we're waiting to see, like, is he going to cry? Is he going to keep going? Did that hurt? Did it not? And the pain registered kind of delayed. And he immediately, like, looked up as it did and made a beeline for my wife. Like, I was closer to him, but he began moving toward her at 100 miles an hour because he just experiences it differently. And I like to think I'm a pretty compassionate guy, but the reality is I can't offer that in the exact same way that she can. And so I think figuring out, and again, I think the Enneagram's a great tool there of where do I bring things unique to my number that aren't just about my gender, but also about my hardwiring that is of value too.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's
That's great.
Helpful
that's great.
Or not.
So especially with y'all's practice and what you do professionally with Daystar and counseling, I really thought this was an important question to ask. When do you advise parents to seek to have their kids sit with counselors or for them as parents? Because I know that's such a great thing y'all do. And I've had friends do this where they'll go and just sit with you and kind of go, like, we need a checkup. Let us tell you how the family is and the dynamic. And is there anything we need to be thinking about as parents? But I would say, especially, maybe you can answer both. Like, when do you feel like as parents that's a good thing to do? And then when do you think it's good for parents to say, you know, maybe one of our kids, all of our kids, whatever, this may be a time for them to actually go see someone that has professional experience as opposed to talking to us about it.
The service that you were mentioning is what we call parent consultations, and it is one of my favorite parts of what we do, and it is a lot like a well visit at the pediatrician's office
where that's a great
we're just checking in and asking some questions and maybe saying, how could I create a to-do list or expand a to-do list in this season? And I love that part of my job. It feels so proactive, and I think 100% of the time, that's a safe place to land. Like, if you're circling around some questions, you know, maybe thought, I feel like we're kind of growing out of this, but maybe not. I think it's great. I'm a real advocate of that because I think what can happen for any of us as parents is when we have some particular fears with our kids, if we stay in that space long enough, I think those fears or concerns or questions can start to define our parenting. And I don't think our kids ever get the best of who we are when we're parenting out of a posture of fear and not out of love. So I'm just like, if you got questions and you've got some concerns or fears, like, let's just circle around those and maybe give some peace of mind. And that is, I think, a great place to table that question. If you feel like we're confused about whether this would be the right moment to bring a child in or not. I always recommend starting there as opposed to just go ahead and bring them in if you're not 100% certain.
Gotcha,
sometimes
gotcha.
We are really certain, but I think if you're not, let's table it together, just the adults, and we'll flip it over and decide if that would feel useful. And sometimes it's nothing more than what we talked about a little bit earlier of just a different voice. We say to parents all the time, you know, not just with adolescents, but with younger kids, sometimes we are going to say not just some of the same things you're saying, the exact same things you're saying, but it's just going to sound different because it's a different voice. Like with anxiety,
oh, totally.
You know, you could be coaching your kids in the exact right direction, but they're so trapped the brain being hijacked by anxiety, they just need a different voice in that moment. And I think that's true in a lot of areas. I mean, my wife is an educator, and I said to her, you know, at one point with one of our kids, like, you just need to be a mom. You don't need to be a tutor in calculus right now. Like, you could do it, but there's a high school student that needs to make a little extra money. Let's hire them.
So. Well, and it can be frustrating as a parent when, like the story that you were telling about your daughter, when your kids start to get into something where you're like, wait a minute, that's my thing. This is a slam dunk. I can help with this. You know, it's tough to not be, and probably oftentimes you are not the person in there.
You're so right.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. You are so correct.
Two more questions, then again, we'll free you. Thanks again for doing this.
Oh, my goodness. I love it. I'm trying to behave so I'll get asked back.
No, you're, listen.
Am I on target so far?
Yes.
We have so many more questions for you, too.
This one I really wanted to make sure we asked because John and I talked about this, but I think it's just such a, if I can call it an epidemic, I think it is. But how is technology impacting development and what can parents be doing to protect their kids from these and to regulate sort of what technology is doing to kids these days?
Yeah, we could have an entire day's worth of conversation around that one. And the bottom line is it is. We don't have as much data in hand as I'm excited for us to have at some point to understand even more of the effects, but we have enough data in hand already to understand, you know, if nothing else, I mean, it is going to be a part of our kids' lives.
Yeah.
I mean, the majority of schools are even moving toward kids being on a tablet throughout the academic day. So it can't be avoided. That shouldn't be our objective. But we do want to be about taking what we call brain breaks, that there are frequent pauses. Because with the data we do have on hand, you know, when kids get into what we call the scary territory is when they've been on for extended periods of time. So, you know, if a kid were to be given on a Saturday 2 hours, say, of screen time, break that up into three or four different smaller chunks because the scary stuff happens when they're on for longer periods of time and we start to see the dopamine relief that happens in gaming, for example, that begins to mirror and look like substance abuse in some way. So
at a certain point, it becomes a chemical issue.
Yes, it does. And it's triggering and firing parts of the brain that we've got to pay attention to. So I think that's key. The other place where beyond brain development is social development, and that's the piece, I think, where it's just too early to identify all of how this generation of kids is going to be affected. But we're seeing the early evidence of, in fact, we put a study in the book that was done out of UCLA where they took a group of fifth graders and they broke them into two groups and they gave each group a quiz where they had to look at faces and expressions, much like the feelings chart, and identify what's the person feeling. And then for the next 5 days, just 5 days, half of the fifth graders got to continue using technology as they'd used it. The other half had to go without completely for just 5 days. They all came back together, gave the exact same quiz. And as you could imagine, the group who didn't have technology didn't just score higher, they scored significantly higher after only 5 days. So that's a great reminder of what we know to be true, but again, now we've got science behind it, that
yeah.
it's affecting their social development. We all three yeah. know that 70 to 80% of all communication is nonverbal. So in order for me to fully understand what you're saying, I have to be able to read your face and your eyes and your body and your posture and all of those things. And if I'm only communicating or primarily communicating through text, through social media, I cannot read any of those things. That's not an option. So in terms of our kids' social development, that's a key piece, because we talk about the social milestones at length throughout this book that we keep coming back to again and again. If there've got to be breaks where they're having a chance to develop socially in some really important ways.
Yeah. Do you guys, kind of as you encourage parents, do y'all have sort of milestones you feel like y'all trying to encourage with when they should be exposed to that, how much, mm-hmm. What are the ages that y'all kind of go, we see these consistently being able to better cope with having a phone, not having a phone, being on Instagram, not being on Instagram, Twitter, et cetera. I mean, and you know, PlayStation, whatever. Do y'all have kind of...
We have an amazing resource, and I'm going to brag on it because I didn't have a thing to do with it, but my dear friend and colleague Sissy Goff wrote this incredible little booklet called Taming the Technology Monster that you can get on Amazon for $5 or less. It'll be the best $5 you spent that I wish every family from littles all the way to adolescents would have, because it's got some great guidelines. And more importantly, it's thinking about it from the perspective we're talking about. Like, it's not just opinion or it's not just about the science, but it's about thinking about our kids' emotional and social development. Here's some things we want to be considering. Here's some parameters we can put around that in important ways. So again, it's called Taming the Technology Monster.
I love that.
By Sissy Goff.
That's great. I love that.
Great resource.
On Dadville, we have a final question that we kind of ask everybody. That's always I love how we sort of send off. And so we'll send you off with this. So you've talked about your kids, you know, your family, your three, the doubles, and then the single. Punching and grunting. I love that your daughter did that. I really do. That's maybe one of my favorite things you said, is that you came in and you heard like a higher pitched grunt.
I hate like, girl drama.
I mean, that's just every I think everybody listening to this, what I would imagine, especially the girls and women moms listening to this, are like, yes. Like,
we should sell a Dadville punching bag.
Yes. You
We're gonna
should.
Add that to the merch store.
Please do, and I'm going to send them here to get it.
Oh, my gosh. They can just put their parents' faces on the punching bag. Yes. There's some way they can just sort of yes. slide in. But knowing, you know, you have your family, and what do you want your kids to say at your funeral?
One of the things I'm working with as a one, back to my number, can I tell a short story?
Please.
To lead to my answer?
Please do.
So I have a lot of memories over the course of my kids growing up where I have been either aware myself or my wife has helped me be aware of my oneness in parenting.
What a great way to put that.
And I have a vivid memory of my kids were like 5 and 7, I think, at the time. It was a Saturday morning, and my wife was making pancakes at the stove. I can still picture her, you know, flipping them and the smell of syrup. And my kids had just gotten out of bed and they had all this great bedhead going on. And I came into the kitchen and all my oneness. And I was like, all right, listen up. We got a lot to do today. I'm going to take you to the soccer game. Mom's going to take you to the birthday party. We're going to meet back up. Your grandparents will be here at that point. And I'm just rattling off this list, you know, of all these things. And my wife very gently put down the spatula and she walked toward me. She put her hand around the back of my neck and she said, sweetheart, you are the only person in this house who is interested in your agenda right now.
Oh my. Why don't you leave the room, come
Seriously.
Back in and try a different
It
direction.
Was so, had we been talking more about the space, she should have sent me there at that time.
Right. More grunting. Yeah.
But it was so loving. Mm. It was so loving. And I think as a one, when I'm at my best, I bring a lot of leadership and vision to our family, and I can get some crap done. But when I'm at my worst, I could make the people I love the most in this world feel like they're up for a performance evaluation. And so yeah. part of why I love that tool and part of why I want to keep leaning in is understanding that, so that when my kids reach that point, you know, they could say, I didn't feel like I was raised by a drill sergeant or a taskmaster or, you know, someone evaluating my performance in all moments, but just that I was loved and celebrated for who I am. My daughter is right now in the whole college journey, and you know, so we're frequently going to see schools, and she has gotten these amazing opportunities to interview for these scholarships. We just got back from one a couple of days ago, and I was watching her and weeping. Like, I am so proud of who she's becoming as a human, not these opportunities or, I mean, she's worked so hard. I'm so proud of that. But just this sense of like, when I listen to her talk about who she wants to be in this world, I just think, oh my God. I think, honestly, the first thing I think is, thank God I gave you your mother. Thank God I gave, it's the best gift I've given you. Yeah. You are so much of who she is. And there's about this much of me in you. Just, and a lot of her is the best decision I made. But it is,
I love that.
This evolution of watching these people we love become who they were meant to be, and that we would get to play a role in that in some way. Put our handprint on them is so humbling and overwhelming to me. Like, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
It really is. So, sorry, that was a long
No, that's your wonderful.
Question. That was great.
That question is always so wonderfully that's cheap.
Great
like, I always
question.
Feel so yeah. dirty because no one is ever ready for that. Like, no one's ever like, you know, let me tell you. It's always like, oh, God, let me just, okay, let me,
yeah.
I need to like sit or whatever.
Yeah.
But thank you so much. Oh, guys.
This was so great.
Thank you. I've loved it.
And we would love to have you back because we have honored. A lot more questions.
Y'all are so fun to hang out with. The answer is yes. Definitive yes.
Yeah, we are, as I'd you can see, it. Under and, underschooled.
I just have to say, hands down, our best dressed guest.
Yeah, you are crushing that game.
You are so sad funny. That this is not a video podcast.
Yeah, because people would, yeah. they would leave us to follow you wherever you go next.
Y'all are hysterical.
Yeah.
I have to go to an event tonight, so I had to clean up my act a little more. But yeah. I love this space. I love the setup.
Yeah.
I'm so excited you are putting this out in the world. Yeah. I really am.
Well, let me brag again, just to remind people, David has books you can check out, as we've talked about that the podcast, and Daystar here in Nashville. That's such a wonderful place and tool for, I know, a lot of that we've used through your teaching, but also friends have gone and children have gone, and thank you guys for doing that. But for anybody that's curious, is it Daystar?
Daystarcounseling.org, I think is our website.
Great.
Yeah.
And there's resources and stuff there too.
Yes.
Right. Great.
Yes.
Great.
If you go to raisingboysandgirls.com, it'll link you to Daystar as well.
Cool.
So that might be an easier path to get to it.
Great. And the podcast, is that up and moving?
It's called Are My Kids on Track? And so you could jump on and do a deeper dive into each of the milestones. And then on our website, we have a free PDF of questions that you could download.
Wow.
So they're free. So you could, you know, do it as a couple. You could do it as a small group. But if you want to do a deeper dive into each of the 12 milestones, yeah.
That's amazing.
Resource.
David, you're the man.
Thank
you.
All.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All you wonderful, beautiful, kind people, thank you so much for listening to the episode.
If you have a second, please make sure to subscribe, rate, and write a review.
Unless it's bad.
Because that stuff really does matter.
And please follow us on socials. You can find us everywhere at Dadville Podcast.
Also, you can follow us each at Dave Barnes Music and at John McLaughlin to find out more about our music.
Thanks for listening.